You're listening to Not Another Business Show, inspiring entrepreneurs to think smart, not small.
Staff or no staff? At some point, every business owner will be faced with that very question.
Depends on where the bottleneck to the business lies and where the business needs to build out its portfolio of skills.
The business owner is so passionate about what they do, but the employees have come along because they want a job. You know, you forget that business isn't all-consuming to the employees.
Employing staff is just one of those things you have to do, and quite often people are reluctant to do it. But at the end of the day, taking on staff is what you're in business to do, and you should be employing staff to take over tasks that you don't want to or shouldn't be doing within your business.
The traditional path to grow and scale has been to employ staff, have them come to your office and work 9 to 5. As your business grew, so did the number of staff. Somewhere over the years, businesses discovered outsourcing. First, the banks and telcos outsourced to call center companies, and then gradually smaller businesses were able to outsource. Until today, it's possible to run an entire worldwide business with thousands of workers and never actually employ anyone. Today, the experts and I look at staff, the traditional staffing path. At what point should you look at adding staff to your business? And how do you go about finding the best staff for your business?
Not Another Business Show is brought to you by Daunted to Done, your virtual project manager. To implement and execute your business ideas, you need Daunted to Done.
Figuring out at what point you look at putting a staff member on is something that can cause a lot of grief to us as business owners. Who do we look for? What kind of staff member is going to be the right fit for our business? Do we want an all-rounder, or are we looking to fill a specific skill gap within the business? Or do we skip it all and go to outsourcing?
Maybe a good way to think about it is, where do I naturally get my passion from? Because that's energizing, right? If you're working on the piece of the business that you love, then it doesn't matter how hard you work, you're just going to get more passion and more, you know, more energy from it. So answer that question. And that's probably where you might look at, kind of bringing someone in first.
That's Matt from Rising Tide Ventures. Most business owners tend to start with a customer service or admin kind of role. So I wanted to check in with Kate from Lightbulb Training at this point to find out what she's seen when it comes to recruiting a customer service person.
A lot of businesses do what we call hopeful recruitment. You know, they either put the ad out or they go through a recruitment company and they hope and pray and cross their fingers and go to sleep at night with the biggest dream that I'm just going to find the right person that's got that right amount of customer service flair. And a lot of the times it just, for whatever reason, it doesn't work.
Hopeful recruitment. I have to admit this made me laugh, probably because I've done my fair share of that over the years. But back to Matt. He has his own rule of thumb theory on when a business should look at bringing a staff member on. And it's a combination of income and processes that he uses as the basis of his theory.
Let me give you sort of a rule of thumb that I like to use. I encourage people not to even consider that question until they're at that 80% of past income phase. And the reason I kind of draw the line there is below that, I worry that people will be thinking of ways to bring on people, whether that's outsourcing, offshoring, whatever it might be, too early before their business really needs it. And also, they're you know, their own internal processes probably aren't going to be defined enough. So they need to be much closer to the business model. How do customers get attracted? How do we service them? How do we run the business? What are the processes around that? And it's going to evolve. It's probably going to change three or four times between bootstrapping and that 80% of income kind of stage. Once you're at 80% of income, you've probably also got a little bit of cash now that you can afford to hire someone in.
80% past income. What Matt means by this is if you've gone from being an employee, say in a corporate role, don't even think about employing a staff member until your business is earning at least 80% of what you used to take home. Even that figure might be a little aggressive for some. I was keen to sanity check this thinking with our self-confessed boring and dependable accountant, Robert King. So I checked in with him around the numbers behind bringing a staff member on board. And of course, he was able to shed some light on the practical things to consider before employing someone.
From a purely accounting point of view, there are a number of things you need to consider. So obviously there's things like having to pay them super is probably the main one that people look at. You've got to consider, does that person come under a particular award? And if so, what's the minimum you have to pay them? Under that award, do you have to pay them extra for tools or time in lieu or all these other things that may be under that award? So getting a handle on what award they come under is very important. And that's sometimes no easy task in itself, trying to work that out. Apart from those things, you've also got to think of things like workers' compensation insurance. So whether or they'll need to be covered under workers' comp, and that's an area that a lot of businesses, particularly startups, aren't aware that they need to do, have a workers' compensation policy. So if that employee does get injured while working for you, then absolutely they're covered for that. You need to consider things such as, are they going to be casual? Are they going to be full-time, part-time? And those sorts of things as well. What leave are they entitled to?
Gosh, I'd figured that Robert would open a can of worms around the practicalness of hiring employees, but super, workers' comp, awards? No wonder a lot of business owners these days are going straight for outsourcing. Places like Odesk and Elance make that a whole lot easier. The concept of not having to deal with all of that can sound pretty appealing initially. But let's follow the rabbit hole for a moment since Robert opened it up. This whole topic around awards seriously does my head in. I know the last time I was employing people in my coffee business, it took me hours just trying to figure out what award suited what and whether or not they should be state or federal based. So time to check in with the HR expert, Alison McGrath from McGrath HR. And the first thing I wanted to know was, what the hell are Fair Work standards anyway? Sounded like a whole lot of bureaucratic red tape to me.
Fair Work and the National Employment Standards are what has been set down by legislation so that basically everybody follows the same rules. So every business owner is compliant with the same rules and expectations across the board, and it's monitored very carefully. For instance, like wages, for instance, it's important that people are paid the minimum wage at least, and they're given holidays and sick leave, and it just sets the guidelines that must be followed across the board.
Okay, so why don't they just say it's all about ensuring everyone gets a fair day's pay for a fair day's work? So in the spirit of outsourcing, small business owners can now look at getting a HR person on an outsource basis to help them with things like recruitment and ensuring that they are compliant with the many governmental requirements before putting a staff member on. So let's assume I'm ready to look at getting an employee on board. What would a HR person do for me that would help me with all of the boxes that I need to tick?
So usually we've really looked at why they need that and if they are ready for a position. And personally, if it's a higher level than an entry level, I would then work in conjunction with a professional recruiter. Or if they want to keep it in-house, I will coach them how to do it. And yes, then we're doing the scripting, the job ads, and screening the applicants. However, to do a really good recruitment drive, you need someone who's an absolute professional in their field, and they've got the expertise and they've got the network, because recruitment is so different to what it used to be. They need a strong network.
So that's an interesting learning curve for me. Don't know about you, but I've always bundled HR in with recruitment. I guess it makes sense that you'd separate these out. I mean, we talk about niching down as business owners and specialising in an area. Being able to find and source good quality employees would be a different skill set to helping a business remain compliant with the employee legislation. So let's assume we're on track of employing a person. We've now got a clear idea of who it is we want, and we're aware of all the legal requirements. So how do we begin to find the right person to fit with our business and with us? In chatting with Richard Triggs from Arete Executive, he let me know that there are a few things that top shelf businesses do prior to even taking a job to market. And the first, in his opinion, is to take a step back and figure out how your business is going to become an employer of choice for any prospective employees in the marketplace.
Employer of choice is a term that gets bandied around a lot. In my opinion, employer of choice is a great tag, but really what it comes down to is the match between the actual job and the employer and the candidate that's being considered for that opportunity. So it's not a one-size-fits-all. It is requiring constant refinement and attention each time you're recruiting a new role.
Okay, so that's not too difficult, but something I wonder whether small business owners give any consideration to prior to employing. It doesn't stop there though. Once you've identified that, the next step is then to clearly articulate what the position is that your business is trying to fill. Doing this, you have the ability to very clearly define what the key deliverables of the role will look like.
Prior to even going to the market to look for people, you need to clearly define what are the key deliverables of the role. And it's easy to chunk that down into 3, 6, and 12 month goals that are easily identifiable and quantifiable and measurable. So rather than going to the market and saying, we're looking for a sales manager and we're looking for somebody with 10 years experience, have managed teams, etc., your fairly traditional generic position description, is getting much clearer about what are we actually employing this person to do, because people like to do what they're good at. So when you are starting your selection process, or even, you know, your attraction process, it's saying, okay, what do we need?
So once you've identified the key deliverables for the role and you've broken things down into your 3, 6, and 12 month timeframes, Richard advises that then you take a look at the flip side of the coin. Why would someone want to join your business?
On the other side of the coin, you know, you need to think about, what are we offering that's attractive to a potential employee wanting to join our business? And again, going back to good old Lou Adler, because he's a much smarter man than me, he talks about 11 factors.
11 factors. Okay, heads up people, time to get your notepad and pen out.
Factor number one, job match. Can they actually do the job that they're being employed to do?
Number one, job match. Can they do what you need them to do? Richard had a great way of describing exactly what he means by this.
In one situation, it may be that you're looking for a sales manager to take over a team that are performing poorly. They're not achieving their targets. The clients are dissatisfied because the previous manager was terrible, and they need a sales manager who is excellent at bringing teams together, rebuilding a vision and values, getting the culture back on track, and getting people back to loving their jobs and performing well. So that's one type of a sales manager. A second type might be you're looking for a sales manager for a business that is working well. It's achieving the targets set for it by the organisation. The team are quality and are individually performing well. And it's about incremental improvement. How can we sell more of what we've got to our existing clients and look for ways to increase revenue and increase margin? Then the third one might be a sales manager who's coming into a business which is about to launch a new product or service into a new market. And so you're really looking for a sales manager who has the ability to go out into a market, identify the opportunities, develop a good business plan, have that approved by the board, and then implement that. And then maybe the fourth sales manager, to just round this out, is coming into an organization where they are under massive pressure from cheaper products and services coming in from perhaps China and India. So to remain successful, they need to find ways to significantly cut their cost of goods sale in order to maintain their margins. So in each of those situations, they're all sales managers, they've all managed teams, they've all delivered results, they've all got similar qualifications, they would all meet the position description. However, the performance profile, what are the key deliverables needed in order for this person to be successful, are very different.
When you hear it in that context, it makes sense. So now back to the 11 factors. What's number two?
Number two, job stretch. Is there enough stretch in the role to keep them engaged and motivated, but not too much that they feel out of their depth? Criteria three, job growth. Is there opportunities for them to grow in the future and to be promoted, or, you know, more exciting and career-defined developing opportunities?
Two and three, I think, are kind of common sense when you think of it. But thinking of putting a job stretch into the pre-work before even getting an employee is, again, a great strategy to follow and could easily be built into the 3, 6, 12 month timelines. For example, by 6 months, your expectations would be that this person would be able to do X. And number three, job growth. How are you planning on keeping this person engaged in your business? Or are you working on an assumption that one of my mentors told me years ago, you only ever have good staff on loan? Are you expecting the business to grow, change and morph? Where could you see this employee fitting in, moving roles? Or are you thinking that they'd be moving on in a couple of years to the next step in their own career ladder? These are all great questions to ponder, aren't they? So we're up to number four.
Number four, who's the hiring manager? You know, people join companies, but they leave bosses. Will this person work well with the hiring manager? Is it a good potential relationship?
Number four is a kicker for me. Maybe not such a big issue within a small business, but a good one to keep in the back of your head. I've had plenty of people who hired me over the years in my corporate career that I respected and admired. Unfortunately, though, very few of my bosses that I could actually say the same about. And when I realised that a personality clash was not something I could live with, I'd very quickly be on the hunt for a new role.
Number five, who's the team that they'll be working with? What's the team values? Is it a work hard, play hard team? Is it a family orientated team? Is there a good match there? Number six, what are the tools that they're being given to do the job? Are the company making sure that the tools are there to enable the person to be successful?
Number five is a good reminder to me about the importance of personality within the team. Having someone that doesn't gel with the overall vibe of the team can sink your business quicker than just about anything. It creates a toxic environment and one that few small businesses can afford. The tools aspect of the job is one that everyone seems to cover off pretty well these days. It's the things that your employee is going to need to be able to execute the role for which they've been hired. And it often includes things like a car or car allowance, phone, laptop, and potentially even additional training courses, etc., to bring them up to speed and advance their abilities.
Number seven, what's the vision, mission, and values of the company overall? You know, are they a company that's green and growing? Number eight, what about the executive leadership team? I mean, we had a situation in the past where CEO of David Jones was basically sacked for inappropriately dealing with young female employees, and that had massive repercussions on their business as an employer of choice. You know, what is the quality of executive leadership team?
The mission and values of your business is an important one to have nailed for yourself. And in my opinion, if you still aren't clear on what that looks like, you probably shouldn't be hiring staff yet. As for the executive leadership team, probably not something that concerns us yet as small business owners, but one I would substitute in many cases of, say, small family-owned businesses, is how is the business structured around the family? If you bring an employee on, what have you put in place to stop them getting caught in the middle of conflicting ideas that, say, a husband and wife may have around the business? To me, this is where the importance of clearly defined policies and procedures needs to be in place prior to bringing someone on. Make it very clear to the person who they will report to and what the roles of the other family or team members are within the business.
Number 9, is there good work-life flexibility? Does the person need flexibility in terms of external commitments, being a parent, being a student, being involved in sports? Are they a person that wants to work 60 hours a week? Are they a person that wants to work 30 hours a week? So work-life flexibility. Number 10, remuneration and benefits. So are you offering the right money and other incentives to attract that particular person? And noting that REM and BEN is only one of 11 factors makes you realise that it's not all about the money. And then the final one is risk. What's the risk profile of the candidate? What's the risk profile of the role? Is there a chance the role could be moved from Brisbane to Sydney? Or is there a chance the role could be made redundant? Or is it a short-term contract role and your candidate potentially wants long-term full-time job security?
I realised a long time ago that it's not all about the money. And I would think that for the majority of people listening, if you own your own business and have gone through the heartache of startup, then you're already on board with the fact that it's more to life than just money. When you hear the 11-step process laid out like that, though, I'm pretty sure you will agree it's all about having a solid procedure in place that you can follow to get the description of the role right in the first place, and then ensuring that you are attracting the right person.
I think it gives you a good sense that there is actually a good operating procedure and system that can be implemented by employers to make sure that, one, they've defined the brief properly, and two, they've defined the employee value proposition properly in relation to each specific candidate to make sure that for that candidate, they are an employer of choice.
So now we have the 11 points clear. It's time to take a look at what actually goes into a good job ad.
Job ads are actually quite a skill to write a good ad. And I think that a lot of people write really pathetic ads, and I think a lot of recruiters write really pathetic ads, and as a result, they really capture pathetic candidates. And not that a good ad is definitely going to attract the exact right candidate that you need, but when you're putting rubbish ads up and you're getting rubbish candidates, it's no great surprise.
If recruiters are writing bad ads, and they work in this space every day, how do we as small business owners have any hope?
It's a pretty straightforward template. They traditionally have 3 paragraphs. So the first paragraph is the company, the second paragraph is the role, and the third paragraph is the candidate. But what we do and what I encourage is that you kind of turn it on its head. Rather than promoting the company and the role, and then adding an afterthought about the candidate, you actually turn it around and you make it about the candidate first. Let's say that we're talking about that sales manager role. So the first paragraph might be something like, you're a highly experienced sales manager who's achieved great results in your career. One of the things that you most love doing is building great teams, building a vision, and going out there and taking on and winning business, blah, blah, blah. The elements of a role that you really enjoy are da da da. So what we're doing in the first paragraph is we're saying, here is the employee value proposition, and here is the performance profile that is going to attract the right person. So somebody's reading that going, yeah, that is what I am, and that's what I like, and that's what I'm proud of, and that's what I'm good at. Let me read more. So the next paragraph is the company. So this is the kind of person you are. This is the kind of company that we are, or our client is. And we're talking about the elements from the employee value proposition that make the job sexy. And then the third paragraph is, these are the key deliverables of the role. If you come into this role, you'll be expected to achieve the following outcomes. Okay, want to know more? Submit your CV or make a call.
In chatting this through with Richard, I pondered how LinkedIn has forever changed the landscape of recruitment. I mean, with all the advanced search features available on that site, surely you can just type in a few keywords and be contacting the right kind of people that you'd like to work with your business. So I was intrigued why businesses still use a dedicated external recruiter.
The first benefit of using an external recruiter is basically you're just recognizing that you've got better things to do with your time, and you can be out there making significantly more money by focusing on your core business than by getting invested in a hugely expensive and protracted recruitment process.
Like anything, it pays to hire someone who has niched down to specialize in an area. That's why it intrigued me to hear Richard say this about his industry.
Now, I've got to be honest and say that 95% of recruiters in the market, I wouldn't trust to walk my dog. And it's not to say that we're the only good ones. I think we are good, but there are some other excellent ones out there too. But, you know, most recruitment companies populate their recruitment teams with young, inexperienced professionals who are plonked into a job, are blue-skied with commission opportunity, are told how easy it is to be a recruiter. They're not trained properly. They don't take pride in their craft. And as a result, they go out there, they give crap service, and they give our industry a bad name. So I would say a good recruitment consultant can significantly aid a business and can really add a lot of value, but those people are pretty few and far between. You know, you need to feel absolutely confident that, number one, the recruiter is competent, and number two, that they will protect your brand as an employer of choice. Because if they are communicating inappropriately with candidates or not communicating with them at all, that will reflect on your brand, and obviously you don't want that.
The really big take home I got from that came back to Richard's 11 factors that he chatted about earlier. If you choose to work with a recruiter, make sure you pick a company that has experience and has invested in their team by way of training. What about LinkedIn though? I was interested to hear Richard's thoughts on that as an option for entrepreneurs and small business owners.
Essentially, LinkedIn has replaced a traditional recruitment database because probably 95% of white collar professionals in first world countries have a LinkedIn profile. So if you become even vaguely competent at using the advanced search facilities of LinkedIn, and you don't even need to pay for a LinkedIn license, you can do this under the free license, it becomes very easy to search for and find people with particular skill sets. You can, for example, do keyword searches, you can do jobs title searches, you can do industry, you can do location, and quite easily you can pull up a list of people who meet your criteria, and then it's a case of just going through their individual LinkedIn profiles, having a read of those, highlighting those that you want to headhunt directly for the role, and simply picking up the phone. As an employer, you can do that yourself. Most recruiters won't do that, and most small businesses can't afford to hire a true executive search recruitment company, so that's a very valid and appropriate strategy to use. The question is, if you're needing to make 50 or 100 phone calls to get three candidates, would that time have been better spent doing what you're good at and paying a recruiter to do it for you?
I hope you were back taking notes again, because I have a feeling we just got a real inside peek into the best way to source and drill down on finding employees. So now let's assume that we have a job ad and we're beginning to get some resumes in. What's the next step? How do I begin to sort through all of the responses and create a bit of a shortlist?
The CV is the first piece of evidence as to how well this person can write a document and present themselves in the market. So particularly if, you know, for example, it's a sales role, you know, your salesperson is required to write proposals and so on. If they can't write a good CV, they can't write a good proposal. So I would be looking at that. Then I'd be looking at, is there evidence that they have tailored this CV for the role that they're applying for? And again, to me, at a professional level, I would pretty much expect that if my advertisement has clearly articulated what I'm looking for, I want to see evidence in their CV that they have taken notice of that and they've responded accordingly. And then the obvious one is I want to see evidence that they have done what I need them to do before, they did it well, and they're motivated to do it again. Now, obviously, that's not, you can't guarantee that from a CV, but you should be able to get a sense of, if they're talking about their career and their achievements, the things that they're proud of, they will put down as their achievements. And so look to what they consider are their proud achievements to see whether it's actually what you need this person to do.
Richard also went on to give some insider tips in case you get overwhelmed with responses. He was sharing with me that he recently recruited a role in which over 200 applicants sent through their applications. In instances where you are overwhelmed with responses, here are some practical tips to help you cull them to a manageable level.
When recruiters are doing that, they're looking for reasons to say no rather than to say yes. They're going, holy mackerel, I've got 200 people. I have to bring this down to a short list that I can actually manage. So I'm going to cut 180 people out of this process just because I have no capacity to deal with more than 20. If they've got lots of tables and charts and pretty pictures and unusual formatting, they're going to get disregarded. If they make simple mistakes, like in my instance, if my ad says, if you're interested in this role, please send your CV to Richard Triggs, and they send a CV to whom it may concern, or worse still, they spell my name wrong, to me, I'm going to disregard them. Because if they can't do the simple practical thing of doing something like that, it's not a good indicator of future performance. But at the end of the day, the CV has to be of a very, very high standard to get people through the door.
Spelling people's names wrong. That one just really gets me. Whenever I was recruiting for roles over my career, if someone spelt my name wrong, they were automatically on the discard pile. It's just not that difficult. So we have the CVs in and we've culled them to an acceptable level. Now it's time to interview some people. The questions you can ask to get a good idea of the person you are talking to are well documented. Just do a bit of a Google search and you can easily find a stack of resources. But Kate had a couple of cracking ones that she recommends if you're looking to fill a customer service type role.
So it really depends on the individual. But if you want just a couple of questions you could ask, the first question I would always ask is, tell me about your most confronting or worst customer service experience. And leave it at that. And just see what comes out. Everyone's perception of what a bad customer experience is different. Not so much concerned about what the experience was, it's how they explain it and whether they saw it as a learning opportunity or whether you can see that it is still sitting there as a fear factor for them. You want a staff that actually have gone, yeah, I had this really bad situation happen, da 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 da, but from that I now know that. And you're looking for the way they tell you the story. So it's really actually pretty cool that in an interview situation, you're interviewing for good communicators. So get them talking, see how they communicate. Do they give you eye contact when they're talking about it? Is there real passion about it? And do they finish on a positive? Or do they shrug their shoulders and kind of go, yeah, I hope that never happens again? I'd be asking more about, what do you want to get out of this job? Where do you, what is it that you want from this job? And just see what they say. It's open questions. Start a question, who, what, when, where, why, or how, and get them to tell you more. That to me are the top two questions. What's the worst thing that's happened and what do you want to get out of this role? And see whether they talk about getting out of the role, things to do with service excellence, or they're more interested in pay packets and holidays and, promotion. Just see where their mind is at.
Open-ended questions. Get them talking. Identify with their language and ask yourself, is the way they're communicating a good fit with your business? Does the interviewer use similar language? How's their body language and can they maintain eye contact when they're talking? The next step, once you've interviewed some people traditionally, is to do the reference check. Now, I'd kind of thought that reference checks had gone by the wayside, as most people tend to put down their mate's mobile number, don't they? Or is that just a reflection on the type of people that I used to hang out with? According to Richard, reference checks are a critical step in the recruitment process.
Reference checking, I think, is an absolute critical part of the recruitment process. Now, there is some talk that they're not worth the paper they're written on, so why bother doing them? But my thought is that if you don't take the time to do a quality reference check and the candidate ends up performing poorly, you've only got yourself to blame. You need to have a robust template of good quality questions that you ask, and you make sure that you ask them consistently and you ask them well. They're probing questions in order to elicit better information than, oh, did Sally work for you? Did she show up on work on time? What were her strengths? What were her weaknesses? Any issues I should know about? Well, thanks, Fred. That's a pretty average riff check. And yes, sure, the candidate could put up their friend, but I would only reference check immediate direct line manager. If they put up a subordinate or they put up a client or they put up a colleague or whatever, that's fine. I'm not interested in that. I want immediate line manager only. And I want to do at least 2 verbal over the telephone reference checks prior to making a hiring decision. Then, you know, the next thing about it is that, again, coming back to performance-based hiring, we have quantified what are the key deliverables of the role. We've asked the candidate for evidence that they've done it before, they did it well, they're motivated to do it again. So when you call the referee, you can then say to the referee, look, one of the things that Sally talked about was when she managed your sales team and she took over a team that was pretty dysfunctional and was able to achieve some good results. Can you tell me about that? And so it's pretty easy then to work out whether Sally's been honest and forthright or whether she's been disingenuous in terms of how she's spoken at interview. Do your reference checks, folks. Please do yourself a favour. Save yourself a world of pain. Take the time and make sure that they're good reference checks and you won't regret it.
More solid advice. It's time to check back with our HR expert, though. Alison, any additional tips on the reference checking piece?
I always say to them, do you have anything that we're going to find within your reference checks? Do you have any skeletons in your cupboard? And, you know, it's the way they respond to you as well that gives you a fairly good indication. I always go through LinkedIn and Facebook. They're probably the two that I go to, and you can just pick up so much. It's incredible what people write. And you know, you also have to be mindful that if it's a social media, it is social, so you have to look at it with a very open mind.
I'm a real fan of finding out the real person by checking out their social media. Constantly amazes me how much information people are willing to put on their social profiles. On more than one occasion, I've had to counsel my nephew on his choice of reaction to leaving a job. And on more than one occasion, I've considered how blessed I was not to grow up on social media as the millennials of today have. But I digress. We've done the reference checks and we're happy with the person we've selected. Now what?
I still believe in contracts. I think contracts are very important because it just lays out very clear what's expected, and then give them time to read the contract. It doesn't have to be onerous, but that needs to be very clear. They can get a, we always encourage a second opinion. You know, they can have a lawyer or another business owner, a trusted person to read through the contract and make sure they're comfortable with it.
Within the contract, Alison always suggests starting an employee with a 6-month probation, not 3, and the way that would look like in terms of reporting within the business.
It's important that the supervisor is working, whoever their manager is keeping in touch with them in the first week, just daily. How's it going? Are you feeling comfortable? Not over the top, but just checking in. And then weekly check-in for the first couple of months. At the 2-month mark, I would always suggest that you have a more structured conversation. It's not a review, it's a conversation. And you're looking at what they've been doing. Have they reached any expectations? Are they struggling in any area? Do they need some extra assistance? So that's at the 2-month mark. At the 3-month mark, I've been making it a little bit more formal. We're looking at how you're progressing. And that's when you really, after 3 months, you've got a fairly good idea if culturally they're going to be fine. And you know, if they're not, and it's not working out and you know it, you need to cut those strings very quickly. And because it can become a toxic workplace really quickly if they're not the right person. So don't let it drag on. Just go with it and say goodbye. But at the 5-month mark, once again, I would be having another touch point conversation, especially if you want them to stay. It's important to have the conversation about how they're feeling, what suggestions do they have, and are they progressing as they were hoping to. And then at 6 months, if you're keeping them on board, that's when you congratulate them. That's when they're very clear about their position description, the expectations, very clear KPIs, and then they're a fully fledged employee.
There is a term for when an employee actually commences with your business, and it's called onboarding. Alison shared with me why this can be the most critical time for your employee.
The first couple of days, that first day is incredibly important, that onboarding. You know, you hear horror stories of people going to work and it's not even the desk ready. Nobody knows that person is arriving on that day. It really should be the business owner. No matter how big the business is, you know, that person that has employed that person, they should welcome them, you know, and then go and introduce them to the rest of the team and then hand them over to whoever's going to be mentoring them over that time. It just needs to be a positive introduction. Give them the policies and procedures manual. A lot of businesses don't have policies in place. Policies are important because people need to know what's expected, but also from a risk management point of view, you've got to have the policies in place.
So it's important to make the initial few days or onboarding a pleasant experience. It's your new team member's first impression with your business and your brand, so best to lead with your best foot forward. But what about the settling in process while they're under probation? How do we figure out if they're a good fit or have the right skills, etc.?
Even if they've got, you know, what is potentially going to be the right person, we still don't know exactly what they're going to be like once we get them on the workplace, into the job. So that's why we have a nice 3 or 6 month, you know, period of seeing what they're really like. That to me is the best time that we actually get in and do what we call a training needs analysis and find out what it is they've got, what it is they need developing, and whether or not they've got the attitude to do it. Because really that's what we're looking for, is the right attitude. You can train anyone to do stuff that is a hard skill, but soft skills are quite hard to train.
The remainder of the process is really a topic for another show, as I just wanted to cover off the concept of staff or no staff today and what that recruitment process would look like. But before we bring the episode to a close, I wanted to look at one final warning that Richard shared with me.
Biggest lesson I think that I can possibly say, hire well and fire fast. If they don't look right, if they're not acting right within a short period of time, you know, make the tough call and get rid of them.
Obviously, there are a whole lot of things you need to make sure that you've got covered before you get into any of that. But the biggest thing I took away from that gold nugget with Richard is don't be afraid to have the tough discussions.
As a small business owner like I am, when my staff work literally hand in glove with me every day, I'm the best person to know whether they're performing or not, and I'm the best person to make a termination decision or not. And I think that having very clear expectations set up front with the performance profile, okay, for you to be successful within 3 months, you needed to achieve A, B, C, D, and E, and within 6 months and with 12 months, then it's a pretty easy conversation. You can be saying to the employee, you were employed to do this, you haven't done it, so you either do it or you don't do it. And if you don't do it, then you don't work here.
We could just keep following this rabbit hole of staff for another few hours, but the whole topic of managing staff and the HR relevance of business ownership, look, it's best fielded for an episode all on its own. I do hope you enjoyed today's show. There was a stack of practical strategies that can easily be utilised by anyone considering taking on staff members. Don't forget to download the free template, 7 Steps to Hiring the Right Person, which is a collection of all the wisdom that's been shared on today's show. Thank you as always to this week's experts, Matt Dunstan from Rising Tide Ventures, our dependable and self-confessed boring accountant, Robert King, Richard Trix from Arate Executive, Kate Schreck from Lightbulb Training, and Alison McGrath from McGrath HR. Most of all, though, a huge thanks to you for listening in. Don't forget to join in the conversation on Twitter at @NABS_podcast or Facebook at Not Another Business Show. I love hearing from you. If you've been enjoying the shows, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. So until next time, my quote for the week is from an anonymous source. If you think hiring professionals is expensive, try hiring amateurs.
If you've enjoyed today's show, why not share a review on iTunes? And don't forget to connect with us on Facebook and Twitter at Daunted to Done. If you have an idea for an upcoming show, drop us an email to info@dauntedtodone.com.au. Not Another Business Show is brought to you by Daunted to Done, your virtual project manager.
First became a manager in a big business at about 25 years old, and this is a good little story. My boss told me this story. So he said, one day the king of the court and the jester are having a conversation, and the king says to the jester, "You know what, jester, I'm really sad because everybody takes me far too seriously. I really want people to just have some fun and relax and have a laugh with me. But because I'm the king, I can't get anybody to have fun with me. And as a result, you know, I just have to be serious all the time. I really wish that I could just relax and have a good time with, you know, the people in my court." And the jester says, "Well, you know what? I've got the opposite because everybody just thinks that I'm just a comedian and a clown. And nobody takes me seriously. And everybody laughs, and no matter what I say, they, you know, think that I'm just having a joke. And even when I try and be serious, nobody will give me the respect I deserve. I wish people would just take me seriously." So the king and the jester decide that they'll swap jobs for a month. And at the end of the month, they get back and they're having a conversation about how did it go for you. And the king said to the jester, "Well, actually, for me, it's been really great. You know, I've been able to have a laugh and everybody's having a good time, but they still know that at the end of the day, I am the king. And so I've been able to have fun with them, but still, when I need to be serious, I can." And the jester says, "Well, everybody still knows that I'm just a jester. And when I try and be a king and I try and make rules and I try and make people do things that I want them to do, they just go, 'Oh, whatever, you're just a jester.'" So the moral of that story is when you employ somebody, you must be the king before you're the jester. So for the first, whatever the period is, 3 months, 6 months and so on, you have to be somebody that expects absolute commitment and absolute desire to fulfill KPIs. And you have to be strong and ruthless, and you have to essentially dictate performance. And once they've gotten to that point where you trust them and they trust you and you know that they're a performer, then start to relax and have a better time. But I think a lot of employers, particularly small business owners, think, "Oh, shit, I really need, Mary to love me. And so I'm going to really try and be a good person and make sure she feels all warm and fuzzy. And, you know, and if she doesn't perform, that's okay. I'll let it go by for a little while." And before you know it, Mary just thinks, "Oh, well, that's, you know, I'm working for a jester and she doesn't respect the role and the relationship and she doesn't perform. And the rest is history."